Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue collar workers for blue collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. Since 1988, Whitetail Institute has been perfecting annual and perennial seed products specifically for hunters who plant food plots. Their seeds have been engineered to be palatable, high in protein, and extremely attractive to deer. Whether you live in the Deep South or Midwest farm country, they have products that will help you grow your best food plot yet. For more information about their seeds and their blends, visit whitetailinstitute.com. Enter the discount code SE15 for 15% off.
I saw this app.
I got a hit.
In the new limited series, DTF St. Louis, Jason Bateman, David Harbour, and Linda Cardellini star as three suburbanites who spice up their love lives.
Wow.
Don't miss the new HBO original limited series, DTF St. Louis, premiering March 1st on HBO Max.
You're listening to the Pennsylvania Woodsman, powered by Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network.
This show is driven to provide relatable hunting and outdoor content in the Keystone State and surrounding Northeast.
On this show, you'll hear an array of perspectives from biologists and industry professionals
to average Joes with a lifetime of knowledge.
All centered around values aiming to be better outdoorsmen and women,
both in the field as well as home and daily life.
No clicks, no self-interest, just the light in the pursuit of creation.
And now, your host,
the pride of Pennsylvania,
the man who shoots straight and won't steer you wrong,
Johnny Appleseed himself,
Mitchell Shirk.
Mitchell Shirk.
Mitchell Shirk.
Mitchell Shirk.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Pennsylvania Woodsman Podcast. I'm excited to bring you this week's episode. It's a topic that is near and dear to me, something I've been doing for a very long time, and it tailors well with my day-to-day life. So as I've shared with you guys many times in the show, I am a row crop agronomist. I specialize in crop management with farmers here throughout eastern Pennsylvania, and you know, it tailors really well into food plots, obviously. And I got a ton of questions this year about food plot establishment. You know, I had a couple episodes earlier in the year talking about different things from switchgrass to perennial seeding. I did a couple of small property food plot episodes, and you know, I get a lot of feedback from that, and I appreciate you guys giving feedback on episodes. It's kind of tough with this platform, right? You know, you got an I do have social media. I try to stay active on it. I have email, but not everybody that listens to this episode I get to interact with, and I do like your feedback, and I appreciate that. So if you're ever interested, you have questions, or you have episode suggestions, reach out to me, Pennsylvania Woodsman Podcast on Instagram and Facebook. You can also email me, pawoodsmanpodcast@gmail.com. But we're doing a food plot episode this week. And as we approach food plot planting season for the fall, and I think it depends on where you're at geographically speaking, I think northern Pennsylvania, New York, some of that places, it wouldn't be surprising if fall food plots are going in, you know, the end of this month here. I'm typically planting a lot of mine here in southeastern Pennsylvania, up into where my cabin is in north central Pennsylvania, a lot of time from the second week of August on, depending on how the weather cooperates, my time schedules, but somewhere in that range. And I wanted to have an episode that kind of highlighted some simple things, talking about techniques for food plot establishment. You know, I always talk about, I love seed drills. I love it when you can have a no-till drill, and no-till planting is awesome, right? But the fact is, the vast majority of us don't have those. In fact, a lot of my food plots, I shouldn't say a lot, but some of my food plots I'm planting right now, I'm doing with nothing more than a spinner seeder, a bag seeder, and a backpack sprayer. And I've had some really good luck doing that, and I think there's little things to watch out for in order to make that successful. So I have Al Tometsko on this week, and we're going to talk about the importance of setting some goals, the challenges of planting with different weather patterns, time of year, things like that. You know, as always, we can't help but go into a little bit about soil health and relationships with nutrients and things like that. But we really try to stick to, you know, managing your broadcast seeder from seeding rates and managing the species you plant and how you focus that in your fall plantings this fall. You know, I've been fortunate enough to get to know Al here for quite a while. And Al's, again, one of the co-owners at Vitalize Seed. Al does a ton of work researching, testing, and bringing stuff to market. And not only researching within Vitalize, but he loves to go outside the box and ask lots of experts their opinion to help formalize his opinion. It's a very, very well-rounded, very, very well-rounded company when I think about what food plots have become in this industry. There's a lot of good people out there, but there's some stuff that's not so good and it's questionable when you start to break it down. And there are a few people that I would put up as far as honorable and respectful in the world of food plottings as Al. And I appreciate having him on every time. I think if you've ever got questions, Al is a great person to reach out to. Ton of knowledge, wealth of knowledge, I should say, really. And he truly seems to want to do everything with helping people. Like, he loves to gather information, and he wants Vitalize Seed to be successful and have that business go forward, but he truly just wants to help people. He wants to share this passion we have in creation of seeing seed grow to plants and soil-plant interaction to plant and animal interaction, and you to be successful and cater his knowledge to your experiences and your goals. He's a great wealth of knowledge. So we're going to dive into this episode talking about all those things, food plots. Before we do, shout out to our partners, Radix Hunting. If you are in the market for ground blinds, tree stands, trail cameras, trail camera accessories, even feeders, if you're in one of our neighboring states that can utilize feeders during the hunting season, I encourage you to check out Radix Hunting and the list of gear that they have. You can go to radixhunting.com and check everything out. They have quality products in mind, specifically for folks like you who are working hard and don't want to break the bank in what you spend. And Little Mountain Outfitters. Little Mountain Outfitters is a shop, archery shop, located in Richland, Pennsylvania. These guys are a wealth of knowledge, archery, hunting, you name it. And if you go to littlemountainoutfitters.com, even if you're not close to Richland, Pennsylvania, you can go to visit their website and support local business. Get gear that you need for this upcoming season. And if you use the code WOODSMAN10, you'll get 10% off of your next purchase. That's Woodsman10, and you'll get 10% off of your next purchase that you get from littlemountainoutfitters.com. All right, let's dive into this episode with Al. Attention archers, would you like to be part of the world's oldest gathering of bow hunters? then mark your calendars for the annual Pennsylvania Bow Hunters Festival. This annual three-day event is held at the Sullivan County Fairgrounds in Forksville, Pennsylvania, which has been going on since 1957. It's a family-friendly event, allowing participants to engage in 10 different archery shooting areas, including 3D, moving small game targets, a timed clay pigeon shoot, a steel boar, and the renowned Forksville running deer target. There's also a ton of food, fellowship, and entertainment to be made. The 2025 festival is scheduled for September 19th to the 21st, with daily hours running 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. This event is organized by a nonprofit committee, and all proceeds support local needs, including youth groups, volunteer fire and ambulance companies, and more. Visit their website at www.pabowhunters.com for more information, and we hope to see you there this year. Back on this week's show is my good friend, Mr. Al Tomechko. Glad to have you back. It's always a pleasure.
Hey, buddy. Good to be back. Thanks for having me. Likewise, I always enjoy chatting with you, whether it's a podcast or not. We always have fun.
Well, absolutely, because usually when you and I are talking, it means we're going to be talking about food plots, deer, plants, something that's fun. You and I were talking off air a little bit. Lately, life has been filled with stuff that you have to do and you don't necessarily want to do. I'll give you a perfect example of what a picture, a snapshot of my life is right now. I came home from work today and, you know, my five-year-old, my three-year-old are the crazy kids that they are. And I went into the bathroom and next to the toilet, there is a blob on the floor. And I looked at the blob, and the blob is exactly what you would have thought it would have been when I say a blob next to the toilet. So I'm in the phase of teaching my five-year-old how to wipe his rear end. And somehow, some way, he decided that he had to get something, set something down or do something along the floor. That is a snapshot of my life. So I'm trying to think about how I can get food plots done, how I can be successful bear hunting, how I can do all this stuff. And really my day to day is pardon my French. It's sometimes a little shitty.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, that's raising young ones is certainly a learning experience in and of itself, and how to handle all of the ups and downs and sideways of that, and trying to keep your cool while doing it can be a challenge, you know, but it's also a heck of a fun ride.
Well, speaking of the ups and downs and sideways, you know, this year has brought on a lot of challenges in the world of planning. You know, here it is, you know, as we record this, it's right after July 4th here. It's July the 8th. I still have farmers that are debating trying to put their first planted crop in the ground because it's been so wet. We've got experiences with, you know, disease in crops because of excess moisture. There's been a lot of challenges thrown at us. And with that has came a ton of questions about food plot establishment, food plot management, and some of the stuff that we've covered in episodes prior. It's stuff that's, you know, there's a lot of media and information out there. But really, I thought it would be a great opportunity as we go into fall planting season. When you think about planting, you know, some places in northern Pennsylvania, I think the end of July is not going to be too early to be putting food plots in if the soil moisture and rainfalls hold out the way they do. You know, I'm usually thinking somewhere in that mid-August to September time frame for the latitude that I'm at. I just thought it'd be a really good idea to revisit a couple of things to think about when it comes to establishing food plots. And you brought up a good point when we were talking about doing this podcast, and you had brought up talking about goals. You know, you get a ton of questions on an annual basis, probably on a weekly basis, about, well, what's wrong with this food plot? Well, I saw so-and-so did this, and I want to do this. And there's oftentimes, you have to scale back, and you have to slow people down, and you have to go back to the beginning. What is your goal? So, Al, I want to ask you, what defines a successful food plot for you?
Well, you know, in the springtime, I have different goals than in the fall time, right? So in the spring, like this year, we did a lot of tests and kind of have to do testing, right? I mean, that's we're in the business of selling seed, right? And I think it's only fair to our customers or followers or whatnot to always be testing and innovating and then sharing that information. So to me, in the spring, like, we plant our nitro boosted Vitalize seed, and that's a very diverse legumes and sorghum and Sudan, and you got some a little bit of brassicas in there, a little bit of annual clovers, and things like vetch and whatnot. So we're trying to fix a lot of nitrogen, and we're also trying to keep nitrogen from leaching out, right? So nitrogen that was already existing in soil profile, and that's where you have your things like sorghum and Sudan do a really good job. And I'm just talking about nitrogen, but of course there's phosphorus solubility and all these other things that come into play there. By essentially cover cropping in the summer, because our cash crop is deer hunters, which is prime audience we're going to be talking to today, is going to be that fall, right? That's kind of your cash crop as a deer hunter. You want a really good fall plot. So for me, if I'm using a no-till drill, now not everybody has access to that or does that, so it's different, I might set the goal of, you know, I don't care if it's messy. I just want food in the ground, and I want to get a bunch of biomass, and I want to reduce, you know, herbicide load on the field, and that's what I'm going to do. So like this year, we took maybe 50% of our acres based on a quick scouting of the field. You know, we'd go out on the four-wheeler, take a quick look, snap a couple pictures. You know, if one guy was calibrating the drill, you know, the guy was looking to, hey, look at this field. There's 90% of its carbon load, you know, our fall blend. It looks great. I'm not even seeing any weeds yet. We're already mid-May here. We've had rain. Soil temps are up. Like, there's really not a big reason to think you're going to get dominated by weed pressure at that point, right? And you have a good blanket of clover, annual clovers in there. What should we do, right? Well, in the case where you have a no-till drill like we do or have access to one, we're like, let's just drill right through it. So that to me was deemed a success, right? Because we have food, we're feeding the soil, we're feeding a ton of deer, and we reduced the herbicide load. Some of those fields now will not see an herbicide for at least a year, maybe longer. I'd have to go back and look at all my logs, but I mean, significant period of time, and they might get one treatment of a glyphosate in a 12 to 14 month period. Like, that's pretty darn good, right? We also did some roller crimper studies, or tests, I should say, on that to kind of compare that to the drill and drive away method. You know, how does that look? So that's a success too, right? Just to have that data set. And then lastly, I think one of the things that I look for in the fall is a success is really determined by seeding rate, right? Getting that seeding rate right, specific to your farm, your field, in order to feed the soil and deer, right? And that's really, I mean, we of course give recommendations at 45 pounds per acre. If you're broadcasting, jump it up a little bit. But there are so many variables throughout the whitetail's range as far as deer densities go. And guys might say, oh, I don't have a lot of deer. Well, you might not have a lot of deer. That could be very true. But you also might not have a lot of food in the area. And it doesn't take a lot, you know, of deer to eat a lot of food. So if you right. want to, if you're setting your goals based on, you know, even our own website, right? We have great pictures of food plots that we've grown in, and it certainly is achievable. But if you're setting your goals based on those visual kind of picture perfect looking fields, there is some work that goes into that, right? Soil testing and understanding, how am I going to get there? And a lot of times that's a, in my experience, soil fertility certainly plays a role, but I would say soil testing. And one of the biggest things for food plotters is getting the seeding rate right. Not too much, not too little, and measuring it with exclusion fences. If you do that, I've grown some beautiful food plots on 4.8 pH soil with low organic matter. People are like, how could you do that? Because you're getting the seeding rate right. Is it as nutritious? Is it, you know, going to set a world record? No. But my point is, I'll fix that in time. But you got to start somewhere. And that's where I would say that's a big goal for me. And I'm always fine-tuning that seeding rate. So that's something that's, I think, big and important to for people to do. Put those exclusion fences up.
Sure, sure. So you talked about a drill. I have some food plots that drills
are an option. I have other food plots that they're not an option. And, you know, you and I talked about a food plot that I'm going to do this year that I'm taking an old fallow piece of land that has a lot of perennial grasses, but some annual weeds as well. And my plan and what I did to start here this summer is I terminated the grass and what's there with glyphosate so that way I could broadcast into that. And you talked about that seeding rate. So, you know, setting a seeding rate from a drill's perspective, you know, once you do it a couple times, you can pretty much get your settings on your drill that you're used to, and you can just roll on with that once you kind of get in the groove of things. But I get asked a lot of questions about how do I determine my seeding rate when I'm broadcasting, and how do you figure that from if I tilled or if I want to do a broadcast no-till, some of that stuff. So maybe can you go into a little bit more in depth when you're talking about, you know, less equipment broadcasting? How do you view seeding rate in food plots?
Well, I think it really depends on the, you know, knowing your area, right? That certainly is going to be important, but also knowing your blend. So if you're going to go and plant a brassica mix and you're like, hey, I'm planting a half acre and they recommend 6 pounds to the acre, don't just double it, though, because you're doing a broadcast method. One, brassicas inherently do pretty well in just kind of a broadcasted method. I mean, I've literally blown them out of a leaf blower before and had huge brassicas show up. So, like, they grow well. They're very small seeds. They do a very good job of finding their way down. But 3 pounds might not be enough either, right? So you might want to kind of go, okay, I need to go to, you know, 3.5 pounds, and let's see what that looks like on that half acre. So you're increasing your rate, but you're not going to increase it double. I don't ever like this blanket idea of doubling. So number one, I would say I like to start at in general, at around a 25% rate. Now, there are going to be somebody out there listening, well, I've doubled my rate and had great success. Very well could be. But it again depends on what are you mixing. So like our carbon load, I'm very proud to say it's 55% grains. You got around 30% legumes, which is going to be, you know, peas and all your annual clovers, a little bit of hairy vetch in there. And you got a little bit of broadleaves. But then you also have 10% brassicas. So you go doubling that rate on, you know, just because I want to buy more seed. Don't get me wrong, I can sell more seed that way, right? But I want people to be successful. And I don't want people to go, well, man, it looked great, but all I had was annual clovers and grains. I want you to have that diversity. So that's why I recommend around 20 to 30% increase pounds per acre when broadcasting. So let's just say you got an acre field, a perfect football field. It's 1 acre. I tell guys, buy an acre and a half, put an acre and a quarter down and save the other quarter acre and come back in 3 weeks. And if you think there are some runoff issues, overbrows, you know, a pesky groundhog hole was right there and it's coming out every afternoon, just eating out of house and home. Like, right, there might be areas where you're like, this is something I got to, well, now you have this, you know, extra 10, 12 pounds of seed that you can do either a light over the whole, you know, light spread over the whole field, or you can just touch up areas in order to get you the most out of that plot. And that way you're keeping your ratios relative to your, I'm talking more specific to us, but really this is across the board. You're keeping your ratios equal for that acre basis without just saying, hey, I'm just going to go crazy and, you know, throw a whole bunch out. And really, I would recommend that for guys who are doing tillage or the, you know, spray and broadcast no-till. If you're doing tillage in a perfectly fit seed bed, I would probably stick on the lower end of that increase. You're going to lose some to predation, but you're also going to have perfect seed to soil contact, or you should have close to that. Similarly with fertilizer. I mean, guys, like, especially in food plots, without getting into the science of fertilizer efficiency and stuff, guys go, oh, I got a soil test. I need to do 300 pounds of triple 13. And they just go out there and throw it all out. It's like, well, 70% of that's gone. Like, that was, you know, I would be like, it's very similar. Take what it is, maybe go, okay, I want to put down 25% of this now, and let's see the response that I have if you're kind of in that method. And really consulting somebody, is especially if you're not overly well-versed in that, is a good way to make sure you get the most out of your seed. And if you are going to use a fertilizer, you know, or whatnot, to make sure you're getting the most out of that product.
And I like the way you describe that too, because you talked about increasing seeding rates from broadcasting, maybe in that 20 to 30% range. But when you go down to the why behind that, there's a lot of reasons why that could be. Number one, and you touched on that a little bit, and that's how many deer are in this general area? Because if you've got a higher deer population, sometimes you need a higher population to withstand it and get establishment. But you start talking about the substrate in which you're planting. I mean, you brought up a good point. If it's tillage, if it's a beautiful seed bed, this is really nice, nice loamy dirt for the most part, and you've got tillage, you know, you can get away with broadcasting a normal rate and cold packing it and seeing a really, really nice food plot. When you start talking about variation in your soil, and this is where it gets into the world of agronomy, where, you know, we've got a lot of variable soils in our neck of the woods here in southeastern Pennsylvania. And if I've got an average field of 20 acres, I might have 2 acres of it that the topsoil, I mean, is a couple paper sheets thin, and then there's other sections that's a lowland, has really, really good topsoil. We might have a soil change. Well, I see that in food plots all the time, and I think it's because a lot of the food plots that I get to look at for guys are, you know, sections that might have been logged off at one time, and there was sheet erosion, and it kind of changed the soil. Maybe there's a rock outcropping, and you start trying to figure out, like, what's my seeding rate? Well, you've got sections of your food plot that it could probably be 80% of the recommended seeding rate, just because it's, you know, everything you put out is going to take. But then there's going to be sections like you just described that could be a rock outcropping, could be really, really tough. Maybe if you're broadcasting like I'm going to be into a lot of thatch, and maybe you've got a section where the goldenrod in this field was really, really nice. It wasn't overly thick. You can broadcast right into dead standing goldenrod and mow it or cul-de-pack it or whatever. But maybe had a big patch of perennial grass where the stems, you know, are really, really, really close together, and you have this lawn thatch over top, and you don't get as good a seed to soil contact. So, you know, in that situation, you might need 2 times the rate in that one section. How do you know? The way you just described it, and saying maybe a 25% increase and saving some seed and monitoring it. I love the way you describe it. Do you have any other thoughts there to add to that statement?
Well, I mean, you do kind of get into the rabbit hole of thatch, you know, and understanding that if you have too thick of a thatch and that can be detrimental. You know, depending on what the carbon to nitrogen ratio of that thatch is, and, you know, the history of that field and things like that. So that is something to consider. You know, we have our own products and things like that for biological stimulation. But that is a case where you might say, wow, adding a little bit of fertility might be a good situation there. So keep that in mind. Again, on the other side of that, if you don't have any thatch and it's very minimal, you might have more seed predation, right? Raccoons, turkeys, birds, etc. So those are some of the things to just kind of keep in mind. And again, you can fine tune that based on your particular situation. One of the biggest things I would say for guys who are doing that kind of throw and mow or spray and throw or whatever you want to call it is also going to be, to the best of your ability, I know not everybody can do this, but trying to get your planting timed with a rain. I know that's difficult, but if you're in a situation where you're able to take off work pretty quickly or whatnot, you're going to have really good results or better results, I should say, when you can have, you know, rain in the forecast, especially in those broadcast methods. If you're using a no-till drill or something like that, if you got rain within, you know, a 10-day forecast, you're probably going to have, especially fall plants, you're going to have morning dews, you're going to have things that get things started. And that no-till drill is going to protect a lot from predation. But if you're doing the broadcast method, if you can plant it with a rain, you can certainly have good results. I'll give you a quick example. Last year, I've said this so many times, people are probably tired of hearing me say it, but we had a 100-year drought. Worst drought we'd ever seen in southeastern Ohio. It was really, really bad. And I had planted a field that had never, or it had been planted like one other time, but it's a brand new field. We've talked about it before. Poor soil, quality, low pH, blah, blah, blah. Now we're working on it. It's getting tremendously better. But I had a couple deer in that general area that I really wanted to target. And I'm like, oh my gosh, it is like literally a dust bowl. I mean, because this field had been dozed off. We no-tilled right into basically a blank slate. And it's like, there's like nothing growing. Like it's, I mean, there was plants growing, but it was so dry that you could see the rows and just like everything's, you know, a quarter inch high. Long story long, I was like, oh my gosh, it had been, we had finally rain in the forecast, like 3 or 4 days of rain. We really needed it. It was late. Like I want to say it was close to like Labor Day. And I took time off. I'm like, that's it. I'm taking a day off of work. We have like 3 days of rain in the forecast at like 90%. And the drill was hooked up to the tractor. And I ran and drilled that field again. And 29 days later, I shot a 7.5-year-old buck we call Dozer off that field. You know, so I share that story because sometimes, I mean, that getting that planting in with that rain made that feel that much better because, I mean, I had lost a lot to drought and to get that in there. And it was the only field I had to replant. I mean, because the other ones had been in our system. They had thatch cover. Certainly, they weren't as beautiful as previous years. But, I mean, you know, that was, what can you do? It's a 100-year drought. But to get that field in there, I mean, I think the night I killed that deer, I ended up seeing like 5 to 7 deer all in that field eating. And I killed that deer and got out. And it's a pretty big field. It's almost 3 acres. And I remember getting out and sneaking out, and there's still deer, you know, I don't know, 80, 90 yards out just eating carbon load, just kind of hanging out there. Had no idea in the world what just happened. So the point being is like that saved not only an opportunity for me, but it also, you know, fed deer all year. I mean, we had a ton of deer in there all season long. And this spring, I had posted some pictures, but I had some clover, annual clovers in particularly, that, you know, we pride ourselves on using the best quality annual clovers we can. Mitch, I think my buddy Greg pulled a tape measure on it. He was 24 or 26 inches high. Those clovers were. So, I mean, the height we were getting out of, like, fixation blants on frosty burseem, obviously crimson, you know, was in there as well with some really good production. But I think it was 24 or 26 inches high in some areas we were getting the height out of that. And, I mean, it was like, that's a game changer. Because now, you know, we got something going. Now we have biomass. Now we're rolling that over and we're running that drill through there. Well, actually, we drill through and then we actually ran a crimper over it on that particular field just to do a test. But I mean, I'm talking, I got 2-3 inches of biomass there that's laying down, covering that soil. So now when we're getting moisture, we're holding it, right? So it took a little bit of time to get started, and I went on a tangent there, I apologize. But I want to kind of explain how timing with the rain, whether it's a drill or not, it can really help you out.
All right, everyone, it's that time of year where things are greening up and I'm starting to think about food plots. And if you're doing the same thing, look no farther than Vitalize Seed, specifically Nitro Boost spring and summer planting. It's the food plot that has the ability to fix atmospheric nitrogen and add diversity to your food plot mix. It's highly browse tolerant and adds a ton of benefit, not just to the wildlife, but for your soil. 30% more diversity than any other food plot you're going to find, and it's engineered for the proper carbon to nitrogen ratio to naturally feed your soil biology and set you up for a fall food plot like no other. Diversity is king for your wildlife and for your soil. Look no farther and check out Vitalize Seed.
Listen, landowners, let Stephen Chilcote, land and timber consultant, turn your land into a deer and wildlife magnet. With over 25 years of land and timber management experience, Steve's approach optimizes food and cover to attract deer and increase hunting success for his clients. Visit us online at chilcoteforester.com or call Steve today at 814-360-4510 to make sure your land is the ultimate hunting paradise.
I get farmers all the time that will have conversations about pushing the envelope on yield. And, you know, what's the things that guys think about the most? Like, let's just say they want to grow high end corn yields, right? What's the some of the things they talk about? Nitrogen delivery, you know, how are we going to deliver, you know, secondary nutrients? You know, what's our micromanagement in micronutrient programs, stuff like that. And I say a lot of time to a lot of guys, like, look, we can do everything right, and if we don't get the proper amount of moisture at the right time, it doesn't matter how much fertilizer we're doing. You feed for 500 bushel corn and you're not going to get it if we don't get the moisture. And that is, it's sounds so simple, but it's amazing how often we run into situations in the food plot world as well, where missing something as simple as timely with rains makes the world a difference in food plots. I see it happen time and time again where, and this is no knock on anybody that's hunting or planting food plots, but it's just the way it is, where a lot of us will say, well, I'm looking at my schedule I got here throughout the month of August, and well, the second weekend in August, you know, I don't have anything on my schedule that weekend. I think that's when we'll go do our food plots. And I do that as well too. I got a busy life schedule, but what you run into so many times is people go to do that and you have no rain in the forecast. It's dry, or on the flip side, and then it rains and it's too wet. And that creates problems in and of itself when you're in there with equipment and doing things and you make compaction and, you know, soil. Like, having the right percentage of moisture in your soil. And the rule of thumb I always made the statement was, if you can grab soil and you can kind of crumble it up and it doesn't make a ball, you know, you're on the right track. The number was always 30% moisture, but I mean, that doesn't mean a lot to a lot of us. It's, you know, can you crumble it up and you're not going to actually make a compacted mess. But that's critical, having the right, and then obviously having timely rains after you seeded.
Add to that too is, like, you know, we obviously have targets, right? Like with Nitro Boost, you know, guys, I like to tell guys, hey, around 55 degree soil temps with climbing, if we can catch the wave, right, you're going to be pretty good. And what do we say for carbon load? Exactly what you pretty much highlighted. In that, you know, 30 to 60 days before your average annual frost for your area, zip code, whatever you want to say, geographical location. But like this year, we had like an extremely unusual cold snap. I think it was like May 18th in Ohio. So to your point, not only do you need the moisture. So we were like, oh man, we're all getting the moisture. This is great, because we had been in such a bad drought. And we were getting decent temperatures, soil temperatures were climbing. And then we got this really unusual, terrible for turkey poults, another conversation for another day, but really unusual cold snap where I think it had gotten down into the 30s in some of the valleys and things like that throughout the southeastern Ohio region in like late May. So whether you're a food plotter or certainly if you're a farmer, it's hard to say that that's not going to have any impact on the stress of the plant and ultimately maybe even the long-term yield of that particular plant, right? So we try to do all these things, but to have everything match up, if just using the bushel per acre example, every year to say, hey, this field's going to grow 202, you know, there's always going to be variability because that's what Mother Nature does, right? And similarly in food plots, you know, you have to keep that in mind because you're going to have things. And going back to one of the conversations we talked, you know, started talking about offline, time goes quick, right? And neighborhoods change. And it's something I really try to hit on to people is like farm sell. You know, the guy neighbor sells their farm or they consolidate a farm and now there's one guy hunting 500 acres and it used to be, you know, the town used to push out all of that and drive hunt it or whatever it might be. There's all these variables that happen. And if we're not observing, at least observing, let alone if we can quantify or try to quantify the quality of our habitat and the quality of our food plots and the amount, right, that we're producing, it's really difficult to say, well, I have a lot of deer, I don't have enough deer, I have enough food, I don't have enough food. We're just guessing. And that's something I get, like, folks all the time are like, I don't have a lot of deer, you know. It's like, but do you know? And I just was listening to one of these gentlemen who flies the drones, you know, and he was like, most people are like, I think he said 25 to 35% off on their estimate of what they think the number of deer is. But meaning below what they think. So they think, oh, we got a, you know, 40 deer per square mile. They're 25% less than what they actually end up having when they run these drones. This guy had flown a bunch, right? But even if that 25% goes the other way, the point being is you have to realize, okay, either we don't have enough food, so we need to plant more food, shoot more deer, or both, right? And it's just the nature of the beast if you're wanting consistency in what your food plots look like. And I had a guy just the other day call me, goes, I used to be able to grow brassica plots, you know, and I'd get these big radish tubers, and man, it was all, you know, you could tell he was excited. It was awesome to hear his excitement and passion. And then it kind of started to drift, and he's like, anymore? He's like, I can't even get a radish into deer season. He's like, they have pulled it out of the ground and ate the tuber, ate the top, you know, ate the soil around it. You know, like they've ate everything. And he was frustrated with that because it's like, what am I doing wrong? And I'm like, I don't think you're doing anything wrong. I'm like, you know, there could be a few things. It could be soil fertility just from years of everything walking off the field and a deer's rumen. But it also could just be a lot of deer, you know? And those are things that we have to understand. So I always go back. If there's anything you do, put an exclusion fence up because it'll tell you so much about your soil.
100%. You're talking about a drill earlier, and then we were talking about broadcast method. And I've had a lot of people reaching out about, hey, I'm gonna start my first food plot this year. I'm gonna expand upon an existing food plot, but I don't have a lot of equipment. There's a lot of videos and a lot of people's opinions about what you should do for the old, quote-unquote, the poor man's plot. I think Bill Winky might have been the first person I ever heard say those terms, the poor man's plot, and, you know, using garden tools and all the other stuff he had around the house to make a food plot. But since then, a lot of people have come out with their own version of a poor man's plot. And, you know, you get a lot of people that inquire about, you know, what do you think I ought to do? This is what I have. So I don't have a tractor. I don't have a drill, but I want to have food plot equipment. Al, what are some of the pieces of equipment that you value the most when it comes to the quote-unquote poor man plot? Like if I took your tractor and your drill away from you and you had to go out and plant food plots, how are you going to do that?
Well, yeah, we do. I mean, we just, again, due to the nature of the terrain, I mean, we have areas where it's like it doesn't make sense to – one, the size of the food plot. Two, the risk. You know, you're not going to take a tractor and drill down some of these areas just to try to put in a quarter acre food plot in a spot. So what do we do? I mean, we use a sprayer, and we use either I have one of those leaf blower spreaders, which is pretty sweet. I mean, it's just a lot of fun to use, and it's relatively efficient. I wish a hopper was a little bit bigger on it, but I mean, it's pretty good for seed. I've tested some other things with it, like, you know, and like lime or something like that. It works, but it's just you can only carry so much at a time, so it's like a little bit frustrating. But it's really cool for seed, or just a bag spreader, you know, or one of those chest spreaders. That's the other one I was thinking about. So if you're open to using glyphosate or some other herbicide that you find to be effective, I think one of the biggest things is people make it, even the poor man plot or the whatever other terms are used, they make it too complicated. They're like, do I need to do this, this, this? So if you're open to using glyphosate, you need a backpack sprayer, a 4-gallon backpack sprayer. You can cover roughly, depending on how you walk, your wand, right there, you know, how much do you pump it if it's a pressurized one. Roughly with 4 gallons of water, you can probably cover just under a half acre, okay? So you're probably looking at an acre anywhere from, I would say, 10 to 12 gallons of water, maybe 15. It's, again, going to depend on, you know, how wide is the spray, how fast you're walking, et cetera. But my point being is, like, a 4-gallon backpack spray, you can cover some pretty good ground. You can do a quarter acre food plot, no problem. Probably hit everything twice, honestly, with it. So you can do a really good job with that. And a spreader, and most people, I tell them, I go, spray it, seed it, adjust your seeding rate appropriately, like we discussed earlier, and I'm out. I'm on the next, yes. I'm out on the next one.
If you time it with that rain, like you talked about,
yeah, of course. If you can time it with the rain, that's critical. If you don't want to use herbicide, it's going to be more difficult. I mean, just flat out telling you, you know, it's going to really depend on what is in that particular field. So if you have, let's just pretend that you got a decent fall crop growing there. So like it's maybe some rye and clover, something, a harrow drag would be a really good tool. You know, you can get one at Tractor Supply. They're, I don't know, a couple $100, or at least they used to be. Maybe they're a little bit more now. They got a spike side. They got a flat side. You can drive around, rough it up a little bit, seed it, flip that over on the flat side, drive back around to kind of smooth things out. Now you're going to have weeds and it's going to be messy, and I would further increase seed rate. Why? Because of competition, right? So that's kind of one of those things you have to always, it's a very fluid process. But that would be another good tool if you're not interested at all in using herbicide. I don't personally think you need to go through the spraying and then like burn it off and then rake it. And I'm not saying, I mean, Bill Winky's like the ultimate goat, and I've watched everything he's put out for like 20 years. I mean, I respect that. I just personally, like, I just don't have time to do that.
Right.
So for me, I've had quite a bit of success. And the other thing too, cultipacking is beneficial, but I get a lot of questions about, do I need to cultivate? Do I need to cultivate? And I always tell people, it helps. Like, if you have the time, if you have a cultipack, if you have a four-wheeler that you can just run your tires around, and you want to take the time to do that, it's not going to hurt. Unless, of course, you have too much moisture or something. But assuming conditions are relatively adequate across the field, it's not going to hurt. Personally, again, we put a lot of food plots. So on our areas where we're broadcasting, I mean, we spray them, we seed them, and we're on to the next one. We spray them, we seed them, we're on to the next one. And I probably do anywhere in the fall, especially like 4 to 5 acres like that. So, and have success. Now, I have some areas where they're in our perennial clover mixes due to, again, terrain, steepness. But I don't want them to not be attractive in the dead of winter. So like on those particular fields, they're a little bit weedy right now. Not terrible. There's a little mullein in there. Now we had our oats, clover, chicory in there. So the oats are kind of a nice cover nurse crop. And they're kind of starting to dry out, but they're still, you know, doing a nice job of just kind of letting the clover grow up. So like on those fields, that's like a real easy one because like I already have a clover established. So I will increase the seed rate again, as we discussed earlier. I will blow or broadcast the seed into that area of, I'm talking carbon load here. So I'll put a fall cover crop into that. And then I will take a weed whip. And if there is a thistle or if there's a mullein or if there is some other plant and just maybe some of the clover, I'm not worried about getting it perfect because this is a steep, I'm talking steep hillside here, right? But I just want to add a little bit more food because then on the flat side where I have a nice tree stand and a big open 2 acre food plot, right? That's going to be where I can drill in, you know, the carbon load. But on those other areas, I mean, I'm doing nothing. That might be a weed whip and in a situation with, you know, some carbon load going in there just to add some diversity. And then, you know, next spring, that's going to be all clover again and let the deer have at it. So those are a couple different areas. Hopefully I answered your question.
Well, it absolutely answers my question. It's a very complex topic when you start getting into things, or if you let it be. But I think the poor man plot, I've been in the same boat as you. I only have so much time. My goal is to do it in the least amount of time possible with the best results. And I've had a lot of positive results in spraying it, broadcasting it, and walking away. I've already, after I sprayed it, you know, gave, you know, I'm past the label at this point, but you give it 4 hours after you spray and broadcast seed, you can mow that thatch and, you know, it's done. At the root system, it's systemic. It's moved into that plant. It's going to kill it. So I've already mowed that thatch. I've left it go. I've used a cultipacker. I've taken drags. And I don't have a great reason why I do one versus the other. So I think it's sometimes what I have at my disposal and the time I have. But every situation, taking that where you have a seed bed prepared where it's the competition is removed, broadcasting seed into it, and timing it with rain, that's, I mean, you think about it, how was most plants created? You know, how do most plants recover? The exact same way. We're simulating the exact same thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where I agree. I mean, you don't have to make it overly complicated. You know, these plants are pretty resilient, you know, and it really comes back to, you know, what's your goal? If you just want a nice little fall hunting plot, you know, and those are your tools. Similarly, I mean, I have customers, I talk about them a lot, you know, and they'll say, I just do not want to use herbicide, but I'm okay using tillage. Well, then we address that, right? Like, okay, well, how am I going to be successful here? Well, let's look at your soil test. Well, you have lighter soil, or you have good organic matter here. So let's try to maintain some of that, right? Like, let's use tillage. Let's use tillage as our physical termination method, but let's not pulverize this 4% of organic matter. Because you have something here, you have a lot of deer in the area, you're growing good quality food plots, you're using diversity, like you're doing all these good things, and you're having success from a hunting perspective over this food plot, or because of its drawing power. So let's keep it that way, right? Let's keep the crops growing there, highly nutritious. So how are we going to do this? Well, okay, you don't want to use herbicide. Fine. Let's do conservation tillage. You know, do light tillage. You're going to increase your seed rate slightly because you are going to have some thatch cover and things like that. And that way you're using that as your termination method versus, a glyphosate or something like that. We have other people who are like, hey, man, I want a spring that's going to have a spring plot that's highly diverse, like your nitro boost, and I don't want to have any weeds. And it's like, whew, it's going to be really hard to accomplish no weeds. And I've had a distributor and a friend of mine now who has went as far as he consulted somebody like yourself who has a really good knowledge of herbicide and chemical uses. And he went in, he did a burn down of his carbon load. He drilled in, let everything get established. And then he used a post-emergent herbicide that he felt like he had planted for his area, which is Minnesota, a little bit early to where he'd be out ahead of a lot of the weeds that they see in that area. But his nitro boost was already out of the ground. I think it was called dual herbicide, but I could be wrong.
Oh, dual tool. Yeah, yeah. Metolachlor.
And he has like pretty much absolutely weed free, right? Now I'm kind of like, I don't care if I have like a little bit of ragweed or something like that.
Yeah.
But I was impressed, buddy. I was absolutely impressed with his ability to kind of think outside the box and plant. Now, again, that's more steps. That's more time. He let everything get out of the ground, and then he treated. He's like, a couple things had already emerged. So he's like, I had a little spot here and there, maybe some mare's tail. I can't remember exactly. But like his fields, they look, I mean, there's not like a weed in it. Like, it's just like unbelievable.
Sure.
So I share that because that's kind of like the range of different growers and their targets or goals that you see, within the food plot space alone.
Yeah, that's a good idea. So kind of just summarizing what you just said there. So dual with the herbicide you just talked about, the active ingredient's called metolachlor. But it's not a systemic herbicide. It's not a contact herbicide. It is a soil residual herbicide. And the species in Nitro Boost and Carbon Load, some of them are actually labeled, some of them are not. But my experience with that herbicide is once they're what you just described is Nitro Boost was planted, all the species within Nitro Boost are up and out of the ground, actively growing. However, the weeds that you're seeing have not come yet. So he's going on with this residual soil applied herbicide. It's going to get on the plants, but it's going to work its way down to the soil. It needs to get reined in. And now you've created a biological and a chemical layer to prevent the weeds that you're talking about. Now, it's not a miracle herbicide. It's target-specific weeds. I'll give you an example. It's pretty strong on pigweed. It's pretty strong. It's moderately strong on foxtail and some grasses. It's not that strong on ragweed. There's other herbicides you can do this. I think that's really cool, and I'm with you. I don't mind seeing a little bit of ragweed. My biggest thing is seeing grass. I hate seeing grass. If I see foxtail, fall panicum, barnyard grass, cheat grass, I don't care what grass. I hate seeing grass in a food plot. Hate it. And that's just my pet peeve. Maybe I shouldn't be that way. I just can't stand it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's where it's, you know, again, going back to what, you know, what are your goals? And that's really too, again, understanding from a seeding rate, not to go full round robin, but understanding what you're putting down. So like, I'll have guys who are like, hey, I have a high deer density and I want this to be really lush. And I'm like, listen, the nitro boost, those species can handle pretty high populations of, especially when you're going to have deer browsing and stuff. You got soybeans, you have cowpeas, you have lab, things that are going to climb. You have sorghum Sudan, which, I mean, anybody who's seen cornfield or, you know, sorghum, they can handle high populations. So you can seed that. You probably could double that seed rate, even in a drill. And I don't think you're going to see tons of nutrient deficiency, assuming, you know, relatively decent soils and things like that. You're probably going to have a decent stand come up. Carbon load, right? A high percentage of brassicas, grains, you are absolutely going to suffer. You know, so I share those things with people because your brassicas are going to choke a lot of different things out, or excuse me, the brassicas will get choked out, right? The brassicas will be stunted. They're not going to have the fertility in that soil and ability. So understanding what you are planting, or even if you're planting a monoculture of soybeans just for deer, understanding, okay, I can probably plant this at, instead of 140,000 population, right? I could plant this at, I don't know. I don't know if double is probably an exaggeration, but you get where I'm going. You could plant that, but don't plant 15 pounds or 20 pounds of brassicas per acre. You know, don't say, okay, well, that works so good with the soybeans. Now I'm going to plant this at a real high rate because those species are different. And understanding that relative to your soil and to your deer density in an area can really tremendously, in my opinion, help somebody achieve their goal of what they find visually appealing, but also attractive to the wildlife that's trying to pull into their property.
Well, all great stuff, and as always, we could probably go down a lot of rabbit holes, but I want to be mindful of your time, Al, because here we are getting ready for, we're getting close to dinner time. We're both family men, so we want to get back to our families here. But the last thing I wanted to talk to you about, everybody take this with a grain of salt, because Al and I are both biased, because Al is one of the co-creators of Carbon Load, and I've been running Carbon Load now the past few years, and you know, even if I didn't work with Al, I would still run Carbon Load. It is my favorite food plot blend that I've ever used for a lot of reasons. And you know, Al, I've talked to a lot of people that they start talking about food plot blends, and you know, different seed companies have, you know, so many different blends you can't keep up with. And there's nothing wrong with that. I just think it sometimes, like we talked about earlier in this podcast, it muddies the water. So I just pulled up vitalizeseed.com. And when you look at your seed collection, we've got Nitro Boost, which is the spring-summer blend, Carbon Load fall blend. We've got Clover Chicory plus Oats, which is your perennial establishment. You got your premium clover mix, your annual clover mix, and Nebraska seed mix. And so many people, when it, and I'm bringing this all up to say, we're talking about simple, poor man plots, establishment, things like that, and people want to overcomplicate it. Seed blends are one of the things that people want to overcomplicate, and I think it's because of that whole, you know, back to sex appeal, kind of what looks the greatest, right? What's going to be that textbook catalog type picture. And you know, I've had people already, when they start looking at Vitalized Seed, when I make a recommendation to them, they go, well, there's not that much here, why isn't there more diverse? And I've always said, what more do you need? We've got so much diversity in Carbon Load, and with this 1-2 system, you can do brassica blends, you can do you know, clover plots and stuff, but I can't help but end this podcast with letting the floor up to you when it comes to when somebody says, well, that just seems too simple. You're just throwing a hodgepodge of stuff together, and you know, why is that? How is that any better than me? I love my brassica food plots. Listen, you've heard it a ton. Like, what's your response, Al?
Well, I mean, people can like whatever they like, right? But from a business perspective, you know, we have to be efficient, and we have to understand, you know, we're focused very much on soil health and science, and we love deer hunting too, right? You know, we're doing large cover crop orders now for some farmers and things like that, and doing custom blends to achieve people's goals. So one of our targets with carbon load and nitro boost is specific to the ratios. So there's might be a lot of mixes out there, and they'll be 80, 90% grains. A lot of times it's one grain because it's whatever they, you know, can get at a cheaper cost. Nothing wrong with that again. But it's 80 or 90% grains, and you have a little bit of this and that. And then people say, ah, I didn't have the brassicas I liked. So we really have prided ourselves on making sure that the ratios of the mix and also what makes up those ratios. So we don't just put in tuber production brassicas because they're the cheapest, but we also want to make sure that we put in forage varieties. Well, why? Well, all the things we just talked about, right? There's a lot of people who have a lot of deer, and you want to be able to have brassicas that a deer can eat, and it's going to want to put on another leaf, right? Similarly, why do we not just use rye grain, or maybe 1 year oats is the cheapest? Or, well, why not? Well, because everybody's, you know, you'll talk to five different guys, you get 10 different opinions. Some guy says they like triticale. Some guy says they like rye. Some guy says they like oats. So we put all of them in there. We put winter wheat in there as well. You know, so we really take our mixes and our balance of ratios very seriously. And then we finish off our mixes with using the highest quality annual clovers we can get. So this year we just added Enhanced Persian, which is awesome. Annual clover. So it's actually 17 species this year. That particular clover we have in our annual blend, I had done some testing with it last year, and then also even as a frost seeded annual. You have to do kind of late when you're frost seeding annual clovers, but I call it filling the gaps. So if you have a feel of carbon load or a feel of brassica that got hit really hard by deer, and it's simply looking like, man, I'd like to fill this in a little bit before I put in my nitro boost, which is what I did. I broadcasted around 6 pounds, so not a crazy high rate, but around 6 pounds the acre of an annual clover mix. And that clover, I like to say it's like alfalfa, but easier to grow. So it looks like alfalfa. It grows nice and tall like alfalfa. It has great stem density like alfalfa, but it's not as needy as alfalfa, right? It's not as long-lived. It's not a perennial, you know, all of those things. So that's really what we try to do, is we try to tell people, when you look at our mix or mixes, we try to be limited so we can answer your best questions, and also because we've spent so much time and effort balancing these mixes and getting them right, there's no reason to try to reinvent the wheel and make 30 other different mixes, right? So we just stick to what we know, which is high diversity mixes. And then we've done some things like you mentioned, came out with brassicas. Well, why? Well, because so many people like our mixes and they want that same brassica mix, but they do want to still put in a monoculture of brassicas. I recommend we put some bundles on our website. We have a fall fertility budget bundle, I think it's called, and it's the annual clover with the brassica. Because I'm still like, hey man, if you're going to put in brassica, at least mix it with the annual clovers, right? Like, don't just do a monoculture of brassicas, because if the deer leave it, then you're left with a field that's basically just barren, and then you get a lot of rain and snow, and you're just leading to compaction issues or leaching of nutrients or whatnot. So don't, I don't love monoculture brassicas still, but if you want to use that to make your own mix or something like that, you're going to get all those top quality brassicas that we use. And that's really our focus, right? We're focused on soil health, feeding deer, and making sure that those mixes are premium, not only in the stuff that's in them, but also what we pride ourselves on is the ratio of things that are in those mixes.
And that was the answer I was looking for and expecting, and I thank you for. Now, I'm going to add into this. When you start talking about, you said about, we're not trying to reinvent the wheel. We don't need to reinvent the wheel. I completely agree with that statement. And when I think about going back to the beginning of what we were talking about with simplicity and everything else when it comes to food plot establishment, there are few food plot blends out there that I think are going to handle the browse tolerance and then also provide a wide range of food plot forage throughout a hunting season. You know, give you an example. Somebody was talking to me, we had a conversation about clover, and they're like, I think clover is an overrated food plot. And I like clover. Everybody's got their instance. But whenever you're talking about a monoculture, they typically peak and have a very, very short, a much shorter attraction period in that specific location. It depends on your deer density. There's a lot of things that go to it. And then the volume that they can withstand that browse is different. What food plot can you put out there that has diversity that's going to cater to the minute it comes out of the ground into late season with the volume that Carbon Load has? There's other blends out there that other seed companies make, and they might compete with it, and I'm not going to deny that. But when you talk about comparing it to a lot of the food plot logic that is out there with a monoculture of brassicas next to a monoculture of legumes, next to a monoculture of cereal grains, all that stuff. In my opinion, from the simplicity standpoint and the volume browse standpoint, how can you beat something that has a multi-species and then trust somebody like yourself who's done such a good job of catering those ratios appropriately? To me, it's absolutely a no-brainer. So I wanted to add that in because that's probably the main conversation I've had. You know, we can get into the science and the soil and everything about it. When you get into the deer hunting, how difficult do we have to make this here?
Well, right. And that's where I think that it really stands out. And again, it comes down to those ratios. You know, we have things like oats in there. While people are, well, you know, your ratio of oats is only a smaller percentage compared to the other things. It's like, well, that's right. Because you just want oats early in attractiveness, but in most of the whitetails range, they freeze out. We want to make sure that something comes back the next spring. You know, and then for the guys who turkey hunt, I never, because I'm not a turkey hunter. And I do have some friends who hunt the farm, just one or two, that... the feedback on that is like, whatever's in this mix, just keep planting it for me because the turkeys love it. Well, it's all your annual clovers, you know, and there's no secret to that. There's also a science to making sure that your mix has things that you're not going to be fighting later, right? Don't, you know, put a bunch of perennial clovers in there because somebody got a deal and now they got, you know, medium red clover in there. Well, you know, and we did that the hard way. We had put medium red in our very first carbon load, and it's a great clover. But then guys are like, well, hey, I want this to be kind of an annual food plot. Now I got this medium red that's spreading like crazy. So it's like, okay, let's back off that and let's keep all annual clovers in there, right? So just learning little things like that that help to, you could certainly could get rid of a lot of things in there that would make it cheaper to produce. But when you look at everything that's in there, plus the inoculant, it's a great product. I mean, the feedback's there. You know, we have reviews on our website. We've grown as a business, and we couldn't do it without people like you who are testing the product and sharing the information. And then, of course, the customers that are like, "This, we're just thrilled with it." You know, so if you like it in the fall, you're going to even love it in the spring. I think it's one of the most beautiful times of year is watching that field green up with all of the different clovers and grains and everything like that. I just love it.
Absolutely. Well, Al, as always, it's a pleasure to have you. I appreciate you sharing your knowledge on some of these topics. Anything you want to leave us with before we close this one out?
Oh, man. Thank you. Thank you so much. And yeah, just Vitalize Seed on all social media platforms. If anybody's interested, shoot us an email. We have a chat feature. Shoot us a text. Shoot us a call. We'd love to chat with you. And I appreciate you, Mitch. Thank you so much.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
You saw the game-winning play once, but have to replay it 3 times on the way back to the hotel. Because some moments don't end at the buzzer. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
Ready to relax in your dream bath retreat without the stress of figuring out every detail yourself? At the Home Depot, your bath upgrade is covered. Shop fully designed rooms and curated bath collections to go from inspiration to transformation fast. Savings of up to 40% will make it easier on your budget. And find everything you need, from tubs to toilets and all the tile in between, to bring your vision to life. The Home Depot. Dream baths built here.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network. And this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.